This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, November 26, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. ground forces seize a major airstrip in Afghanistan, putting the last Taliban stronghold in striking distance of U.S. troops. A Florida professor jailed for 3.5 years and then released has been rearrested. We'll tell you why. And U.S. Treasury raids on suspected terrorist holdings in the U.S. raked in a lot more than just cash. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. World representatives are brokering a deal in Germany that will create a new government for Afghanistan. Charles Michael Ray reports from Bonn.
The spokesperson for the UN Special Envoy, Ahmed Fazi, says the four groups participating in the talks will include the Northern Alliance, plus representatives of the exiled Afghan King Zahir Shah, along with representatives of the Peshawar and Cyprus groups. Fazi says the type of temporary administration set up in Afghanistan will depend on the agreement of the four factions involved.
The problem is a very complicated one, as you know. After 22 years or more of conflict, the people of Afghanistan desperately need peace to rebuild their country. There are many factions, there are many groups, there are many opinions. It is difficult to reconcile them all. I think that by agreeing to come to Petersburg, the parties have made a good start.
Fazi adds that women are included in the delegations at the talks, and he stresses the urgency of installing a temporary administration quickly to create and maintain stability in Afghanistan. It remains to be seen what role the new Afghan government will play in the immediate problems, such as the plight of refugees and the restoration of food and medical supplies to bombed-out areas. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Bonn.
The U.S. Senate is expected to vote on and approve a multi-million-dollar radio project called Radio Free Afghanistan, designed to explain the bombings to the Afghan people. Chris Rizzo reports from Sacramento.
The House has already approved California Republican Ed Royce's $27.5 million proposal. Royce says the pro-American broadcast will build on the post-World War II successes of anti-communist radio transmissions sent behind the Iron Curtain. But skeptics caution that without airing a variety of political perspectives, Radio Free Afghanistan could wind up sounding like a government PR project. UCLA war propaganda expert Nancy Snow says even allowing dissident voices on the air may not be enough to overcome anti-American sentiments, especially as bombs continue to rain down upon Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Chris Rizzo in Sacramento.
A walk for healing and peace, led by the relatives of those killed in the September 11th attacks, began on Sunday in Washington, D.C. Vanessa Tate has the story.
The group of about 30 left from the gates of Georgetown University and walked past the White House, where Amber Amundson, whose husband was killed in the attack on the Pentagon, read a letter to President Bush, which said in part,
"When we buried my husband, an American flag was laid over his casket. My children believe the American flag represents their dad. Please let that representation be one of love, peace, and forgiveness. I am begging you, for the sake of humanity and my children, to stop killing."
Amundson said she hopes the walk, sponsored by Voices in the Wilderness and endorsed by many peace groups, will remind Americans of the hundreds of thousands of people suffering from war and economic hardship in Afghanistan and the Middle East. The walk will conclude next Sunday in New York City, symbolically linking the two U.S. cities hardest hit on September 11th. In between, the walkers will speak at local events in Baltimore, Philadelphia, Paterson, New Jersey, and other locations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Vanessa Tate.
And finally, AIDS activists in South Africa are pushing for anti-HIV drugs to be made available to the public immediately and are in court to force the issue. Naeem Gina reports from Johannesburg.
The South African government today faced South Africa's main HIV-AIDS lobby group, the Treatment Action Campaign, in court over demands that it makes the antiretroviral drug nevirapine available to pregnant mothers. The result of the case will affect some 70,000 HIV-infected babies born in South Africa annually. Studies show that only one nevirapine tablet to a woman in labor and half a teaspoon of nevirapine syrup to her baby within 72 hours of being born can prevent half of all mother-to-child HIV infections. The government's response has been that the drug is not proven to be safe and that it has severe budget constraints. Some HIV/AIDS activists believe, however, that the delay in providing the antiretroviral has less to do with safety and more to do with President Thabo Mbeki's position that HIV does not cause AIDS. The government has identified 18 test sites throughout the country where it says nevirapine will be tested. However, the judge in the case remarked today that it seemed to him that the program of providing the drug should be extended all over the country as soon as practically possible. While legal arguments were being exchanged in court, thousands of TAC supporters marched in various cities nationally in support of the court action. This is Naeem Jina in Johannesburg for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
More than 500 U.S. Marines have taken an airstrip in southern Afghanistan. It was the first major seizure of Afghan territory by American ground forces in the war against the Taliban. Jeremy Scahill has more in this report.
The Bush administration's attacks against Afghanistan have risen to a new level today, with the first confirmed conventional U.S. forces landing in southern Afghanistan. Some 1,000 U.S. Marines are said to have taken over an airstrip outside of the southern Taliban stronghold of Kandahar. And as the Pentagon suggested that more troops would follow, the Taliban said they would fight the American soldiers to the death. It's undoubtedly the beginning of a new phase of the U.S. attacks against Afghanistan, and one which could see a dramatic rise in the number of American soldiers and intelligence officers killed. Today at the White House, President Bush said the country should prepare for what he called casualties.
This is a dangerous period of time. This is a period of time in which we're now hunting down the people who are responsible for bombing America. I said a long time ago, one of our objectives is to smoke them out and get them running and bring them to justice. We're smoking them out, they're running, and now we're going to bring them to justice.
As U.S. Marines position themselves in the south of Afghanistan, the situation in the north has taken several twists. In the city of Mazar-i-Sharif, the first significant area seized by the U.S.-backed opposition forces, hundreds of Taliban prisoners staged an uprising within an ancient fort that had been converted into an opposition headquarters. Despite Pentagon and opposition claims that the uprising ended Sunday night, the revolt continued and escalated today. Reports from the area say that as many as 400 prisoners have been killed by U.S. bombs, while more than 100 opposition fighters were killed as they tried to retake the fort. American bombs dropped on the compound also killed six opposition fighters, and the Pentagon said today its own bomb injured five U.S. soldiers, who are now reportedly in serious condition. This followed reports by Time magazine and other news organizations that an American soldier had been killed inside the fort, but other news agencies report that he worked for the CIA. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
I've seen some reports that are of a kind with the ones in the press. Until the compound is secured, which at the last word I received this morning, it has not been, we will not know the answers to those questions.
As the attacks against Afghanistan move into a new phase, one which has already brought reports of American deaths and injuries, the Bush administration threatened Iraq again today, saying the country would pay if it did not allow weapons inspectors to return. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
A United Nations brokered conference on the future of Afghanistan starts in Bonn, Germany tomorrow, but as Tony Cross reports from Kabul, not everyone will be at the table.
Things are looking increasingly grim for the Taliban, with the U.S. promising to send more troops to fight in Kandahar. This weekend, their fighters surrendered their heavy weapons at Kunduz and at the village of Maidan Shah, which is on the Kabul-Kandahar road. And late Saturday night, Kabul's Northern Alliance rulers proudly announced that the Taliban's Deputy Interior Minister, Mullah Al-Haj Mohammed Haqsa, had defected to their side. The mullah called on other Taliban doubters to follow his example. Alliance President Burhanuddin Rabbani then offered a pardon to Taliban rank-and-filers and foreign jihadis. Mullah Haqsa said he was joining the alliance to end the influence of foreigners, which he said is destroying the country. That's a reference to the holy warriors from the Arab world, Pakistan and other Islamic countries who have a huge influence over the hardcore Taliban. So what does he think of the U.S.'s influence over the Northern Alliance?
The main point for the United States was they were supposed to eliminate the terrorists in the Northern Alliance. didn't want the U.S. troops to intervene in our affairs directly. That's why they said that we are operating against the terrorists, to eliminate the terrorists from our country. And that's why there were a coalition between the Northern Alliance, and they started their operation against the terrorists. And about the future of this coalition, we will see when the terrorists will be eliminated. We will see with the United States what could we do with them.
Mullah Al-Haj Mohammed Haqsa, it may not be entirely coincidental that all this is happening just before the Bonn conference. The Northern Alliance certainly wants to stamp its authority on negotiations for a future government, especially since its leaders lack authority with the country's largest ethnic group, the Pashtuns. That's also a problem for the Bonn conference, which looks like only having representatives from the alliance, exiled King Zahir Shah, who hasn't set foot in the country for 30 years, and groups of exiled intellectuals. When he announced the conference last week, UN Deputy Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Francesc Vendrell, said that it's the best they can do at the moment.
The United Front on the one side and the former King of Afghanistan on the other, plus these small groups, do represent the large majority of people. To start with, of course there will be some people dissatisfied, but we are not setting up, please remember, we are not setting up the future government of Afghanistan. We are looking to set in motion a process leading to the establishment of a very interim council prior to the convening of a lawyer general.
Francesc Vendrell, ordinary Afghans desperately hope that they will finally get peace and stable government. Here's Abdul Fattah, who makes a living writing other people's letters to city officials from a stall in downtown Kabul.
The big point that I'm worried about is the war, because the people want peace, and we want peace to be here, and there will be no war and no fighting in the streets, and we want peace.
But no one has forgotten the early 1990s, when infighting between the factions who now rule Kabul reduced much of the city to rubble. The Bonn conference is supposed to lead a grand council of elders, a lawyer Jirga, and maybe elections someday. But with Pashtun leaders running their own show in the east and the south, fighting continuing in Kandahar, and Badghis province reduced to a no-go area by banditry, Afghanistan still seems a long way from peace. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tony Cross in Kabul.
On Saturday, a former University of South Florida professor who was previously jailed for 3.5 years on secret evidence allegedly tying him to terrorism was rearrested Saturday morning for overstaying his visa. Free Speech Radio's Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
When Mazen Al-Najjar left his home Saturday to get quarters to do his laundry, INS agents were waiting to take him away. According to Justice Department officials, his arrest is not based on any new evidence or classified information related to his detention for his perceived association with terrorists. Instead, it was for overstaying his student visa. Al-Najjar has been fighting deportation since before he was detained on secret evidence charges. A federal appeals court affirmed a deportation order against him last month, and federal authorities say that is why the INS detained him on Saturday. His arrest is the latest chapter in a 7-year controversy that started with accusations that he and others at a University of South Florida-affiliated think tank were funding a Middle East terrorist group, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. He was detained without charges on the basis of secret evidence that he has never seen. He was never charged, and he has always maintained his innocence. Deportation orders would send him to the United Arab Emirates and his wife to Saudi Arabia, their last residences before moving to the U.S. Both their attorneys say neither country will accept them. They say the government is using Al-Najjar as a test case for expanding its anti-terrorism powers in the wake of the September 11th attacks, and they plan to appeal his deportation all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has seen many high-ranking officials defect from his government over the past decade to Europe and other Western countries. One such figure is ex-Iraqi Chief of Staff Nizar al-Khashoggi, who fled Iraq in 1998 and now resides in Denmark. Last month, a Danish newspaper broke the story that al-Khashoggi may be guilty of crimes against humanity. From Copenhagen, Patrick Beckett reports.
The ex-Iraqi general Nizar al-Khashoggi was denied political asylum, but granted permission to stay in Denmark, where he has been living since 1999. In the wake of the September 11th attacks in the United States, internal investigations in Denmark revealed to the public that al-Khashoggi may have played a role in the genocide of the Kurdish people. Now he is the subject of a police investigation which could lead to his trial in a Danish court for crimes against humanity. Al-Khashoggi served as a general in Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party's Northern Bureau during the time of the notorious Anfal campaign of 1987 to 1989. During this time, the Iraqi government used chemical weapons against the Kurds in northern Iraq. Kurdish people living in Denmark have offered to testify that al-Khashoggi played a role in the Anfal. There is also documented evidence linking al-Khashoggi to the campaign in the form of audio and videotapes seized in the Kurdish uprising following the Gulf War. Since the renewed focus on al-Khashoggi, a number of Kurdish groups have stepped forward to encourage his prosecution. İsmet Şerif Vanli is president of the Kurdistan National Congress.
I wrote to the Prime Minister, Mr. Rasmussen, begging him to take all measures in order to bring the former general al-Khashoggi before a Danish court for punishment for the part of genocide he committed in Iraqi Kurdistan in the Anfal campaign in 88.
But despite the widespread interest in al-Khashoggi's prosecution, the Kurdish Democratic Party's International Relations Bureau addressed a letter to the Danish Minister of Justice, urging him to end the investigation, and stating that al-Khashoggi is an ally of the Kurdish people. In their letter, the KDP defends al-Khashoggi by indicating the Anfal campaign was directed by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and the leader of the Northern Bureau, Ali Hassan al-Majid. A KDP spokesperson refused to discuss the letter. Vanli believes the group is politically motivated, attempting to shift the focus to higher-ranking officials in Iraq.
Some Kurdish parties in Iraq do not distinguish between two aspects of the problem. The political dialogue or discussion with the government and the ethical problem or the juridical problem.
The KDP's political focus reflects its desire to destabilize the Iraqi government from the inside. Prosecuting an ex-general for war crimes could create a fear among current Iraqi officials, discouraging them from defecting. Danish lawyer Bjorn Elmquist has been approached by Kurds living in Denmark who are willing to testify against al-Khashoggi. Elmquist believes it is important to investigate his role in the Anfal and put him on trial in a Danish criminal court if necessary.
But I regret very much if decisions whether to prosecute or not will become an issue for political decision. That, I think, is wrong. It should be taken within the judicial context.
No Iraqis have ever been prosecuted for their role in the Anfal campaign. This is in part because no international criminal court exists. If al-Khashoggi's case goes to court, it will be in Denmark. Again, Elmquist.
In The Hague, they have only competence for ex-Yugoslavia, territory of ex-Yugoslavia, and Rwanda. That's all. I think mainly because of American resistance. Because plans to make a global, a universal court on war crimes have been blocked in the United Nations. And therefore, I think... Well, there's no international place to send this.
The United States has routinely opposed the idea of an international criminal court, and it is unlikely that an ad hoc tribunal on Iraq will be formed anytime soon, especially if the United States intends to move into Iraq after Afghanistan, as the administration has suggested. But there is no denying the genocide which occurred in Kurdistan, in which between 100,000 and 200,000 people were killed. Hania Mufti is the London director for the Middle East and North Africa Division at Human Rights Watch.
There is no question that these UNFAL campaigns occurred, and part of that involved, for example, the destruction of thousands of villages in Iraqi Kurdistan. That's beyond doubt.
This is Patrick Beckett, reporting from Copenhagen for Free Speech Radio News.
When the U.S. Treasury Department raided currency exchange operations in five states belonging to two Muslim-owned financial networks it accuses of supporting terrorism, it did so under a money laundering law passed last month as part of the so-called USA Patriot Act. Critics say the little-known law gives the government unprecedented access to private financial information and leverage over dollar-dependent developing countries. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
In his first speech to the United Nations, President Bush said every UN member state has a responsibility to crack down on suspected terrorist financing.
We must pass all necessary laws in our own countries to allow the confiscation of terrorist assets. We must apply those laws to every financial institution in every nation.
On October 26th, Bush signed anti-terrorism legislation that for the first time since Watergate makes it legal for law enforcement agencies to share information with foreign intelligence services. The move came on top of a long-standing requirement that U.S. banks keep tabs on their customers and report any cash transactions over $10,000 to the federal authorities. Katie Corrigan is Privacy Legislative Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union.
So, for example, if I had gotten a check from my parents to help me out with a down payment on the purchase of a house, that could raise the red flag. The bank would send a suspicious activity report to the Department of Treasury. And then Treasury turns this information over to law enforcement, but then under this legislation would also hand it over to the CIA.
Corrigan says the law doesn't specify how such information may be used. What's even more troubling, she says, is that the government doesn't need to obtain a warrant or notify the individuals involved.
The root and source of our privacy protections in America have to do with the Fourth Amendment, which not only requires a warrant for a search, but it also requires notice. We have a long tradition in the Constitution that says a person should be provided notice and therefore the opportunity to object if the government is searching and seizing information or other things about them.
Washington, D.C. Attorney Jack Blum, who co-authored a 1998 study on financial havens, bank secrecy, and money laundering for the UN Drug Control and Crime Prevention Office, says privacy concerns are misplaced.
For some considerable period of time, terrorist organizations have been heading in the direction of being straight criminal organizations. They finance themselves by kidnapping people and robbing banks. Somebody's banking the money that goes in, and somebody's handling the financing of all this stuff. The reason that the legislation is so important is it really does disable some of the machinery that has enabled the people to put the money here, but make it appear like it doesn't belong to them.
Blum estimates $7 to $8 trillion are stashed in offshore accounts around the globe. He welcomes what he sees as a U.S. decision to join other members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in blacklisting countries with lax or no money laundering regulations, a move the Bush administration rejected earlier this year. But Hilma Camargo, a representative of the American Association of Jurists, says the U.S. is applying a double standard.
It's much easier to intimidate or to attack a poor individual who's trying to help their families or their regions, people from certain areas of the Arab world, where it is assumed that there's terrorist activities going on, would be much more target than a big financial institution that might be doing things through offshore banking or banking in countries that do not give out information.
The U.S. has so far declined to designate any U.S. banks as global terrorists, despite a congressional report released in March, which charged Citibank and Bank of America, among others, with having transferred funds for foreign banks linked to money laundering, tax evasion, and fraud. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has said it will push for Senate approval of a U.N. treaty on the suppression of terrorist financing and is urging other countries to ratify it as well. The government of Lebanon rejected a U.S. request to freeze the assets of Hezbollah, saying it considers the guerrilla group and parliamentary party a resistance movement, not a terrorist organization. Under the new anti-terrorism laws, the U.S. may retaliate by severing ties with Lebanese banks, a move that could cripple the country's banking system. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
As the nation celebrated Thanksgiving last Thursday, a group of Native Americans and their supporters gathered in Plymouth, Massachusetts to observe the National Day of Mourning. The ceremony was organized by the United Native Americans of New England. They have been demonstrating across from Plymouth Rock for more than 32 years. Chuck Rosina was there and files this report.
Wamsutta Frank James was a Wampanoag elder who began National Day of Mourning back in 1970, and he passed into the spirit world in February of this year. We're going to start today with a ceremony honoring Wamsutta Frank James.
Matoan Monroe is co-founder of UAIN. From a Native perspective, there is little to be thankful for on this day.
We do not give thanks for the theft of our lands. We do not give thanks for the genocide of our peoples. And we talk also about the true history of this country. The way they present it in school is to say that the pilgrims came and the Native people welcomed them and everybody lived happily ever after. That's not true. We did not live happily ever after. So we talk about that true history, and we also talk about conditions for Native people today and the need for us to control our own destiny without the interference of the Bureau of Indian Affairs or any other governmental agency. So we'll be talking about the past, but we're also talking about the present.
The other co-founder of UAIN, Monanam James, addressed the gathering of several hundred people. He gave a brief overview of how this observance of the National Day of Mourning came to be.
In 1970, United American Indians of New England declared the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday to be a National Day of Mourning. This came about as the result of the suppression of the truth. Wamsutta Frank James, an Aquinnah Wampanoag, had been asked to speak at a fancy Commonwealth of Massachusetts banquet celebrating the 350th anniversary of the arrival of the pilgrims. He agreed. Within days, Wamsutta was told by a representative of the Massachusetts Department of Commerce and Development that he would not be allowed to give the speech. And the reason given was, and I quote, "The theme of the anniversary celebration is brotherhood, and anything inflammatory would have been out of place." But what they were really saying was that in this society, the truth is out of place.
Monanam James of UAIN. Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier sent a written message from prison. It was read by Bert Waters of the Massachusetts Commission on Indian Affairs.
Dear brothers and sisters and friends and supporters, thank you for keeping me in your thoughts and prayers for another year. I am comforted by your concern and the importance of keeping my name alive. This annual day of mourning is a sad reminder of our past 500 years. And it is a day we set aside to assess where we are as a people and how we are going about moving forward. We must not be afraid to raise our voices. We cannot sit by and watch as the government takes away our civil liberties. These rights are not given to us by the Constitution or by any other piece of paper. They are given to us by a natural human being, by our Creator. Thank you for your continued support. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, Leonard Peltier.
The crowd then moved out and marched through the streets of Plymouth. They stood in direct contrast to the official city-sponsored pilgrim parade that was taking place just a few blocks away. An attendee, Sarah, explained why she made the trip down from Boston.
Yeah, I'm always here. Every year.
Oh, cool.
For like 15 years.
So it's become a tradition for you to come out here every year.
Absolutely. I mean, this particular day is, I think, the most disingenuous holiday we have among several, but this is a biggie for me. Mm-hmm. It's like core. It's very basic.
In years past, the United American Indians of New England have battled with the city of Plymouth over their right to hold this event without applying for a permit. UAIN has always felt that they did not need permission to march on their own land. This has led to confrontation with the police in 1997 and 1998, but in 1999, Plymouth officials agreed that UAIN need not apply for a permit, and the gathering has gone on without incident ever since.
Un canto.
From Coles Hill, overlooking Plymouth Rock, I am Chuck Rosina for Free Speech Radio News.
Para nuestro creador. Para nuestro creador.
Thank you.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown.